This is recorded on the afternoon of July the 13th in the offices of Professor Emanuel Weiler, Professor of Economics and retired Dean of the Krannert School, etc. The interviewer is R.B. Eccles of the Department of History. This is recorded for the Purdue University Archives. Professor Weiler, let's start out with the question we ask everyone. Will you tell us your early background, where you were born, your education, your professional education, and bring us up chronologically to the time that you came to Purdue University?
I was born in Chicago in 1914. My father at that time was in dental school. He moved to Elkhart, Indiana when I was 6 months old. I grew up in Elkhart. Finished my education through high school in Elkhart.
The noise comes over.
Go ahead.
Received a Rector scholarship to DePaul University in 1932. Entered DePaul in 1932. Was graduated from DePaul in Economics and English Composition in 1937. During this five-year period, I did lay off for a year to work because I ran out of money.
The depression was on, as I remember.
It really was severe. And then in addition to that, I was married. I was married at the end of my sophomore year. This was rather unusual in those days.
Yes, it was.
And Kathy and I both worked our way through DePaul. In 1937, I went to the University of Minnesota to start working a doctorate in economics. But it was difficult in those days to find even assistantships in economics. Since I'd had some business experience and had accounting at DePaul, I taught accounting and finance as well as economics as an assistant first and then later as an instructor. 1942, I went to Washington, D.C. Correction, it was 1941 I went to Washington, D.C.
With your Ph.D.?
No, without the Ph.D.
Without the Ph.D.
I finished the Ph.D. at night, working from 7 in the evening until 2 every morning.
As a matter of interest, what was the subject? Your thesis?
The circular flow of money in the economy.
Very good.
I went back in the spring of 42 to take my final orals and the Ph.D. And then that spring, I also moved to the Federal Reserve Board as an economist. I expected momentarily to be drafted, but somehow I was never drafted. Apparently the pool of young men with two children, which I had at that time, apparently the pool of young men was large and I had two children and they never got to me. At the end of the war, 1945, I was recruited by the president of Ohio Wesleyan University to go there as a department head of economics. This was an interesting experience. The department head had completely dissolved during the war. The present department head had just had a stroke and couldn't continue, and they had no staff members. I took the job, as I recall, for $4,800 a year, which was less than I was getting in Washington at that time, because I wanted to do academic work. was able to recruit a faculty. And really thoroughly enjoyed those 3 years. They were the most exciting 3 years I think I've ever had.
I heard very nice things about you from Ralph Burns.
Oh, yes. Ralph helped. I think I had known Ralph during the war as a result of my thesis and some other work I'd done with him. And he, as a graduate of Ohio Wesleyan, had given my name to the president. Ralph's a nice person. In 1948, Howard Bowen, who had just gone to the University of Illinois as dean of the School of Commerce, had gotten in touch with me and said that he had a substantial budget to recruit a new economics department at the University of Illinois. I went there in 1948, reluctantly, because I had thoroughly enjoyed the Ohio Wesleyan experiences. Now, Howard did recruit a good economics department, but he unfortunately already had an economics department. So this created problems. In 1948 and 49, when there were large numbers of students, there were no problems. But in 1950, it was perfectly clear that there were a redundant number of professors in the economics department. And the quarreling started. This took the form of articles in the Chicago Tribune, a local newspaper, in which it was alleged that the new economics department that had come in was full of Easterners and Harvard pinks and other kinds of...
Somehow or other, they were un-American.
They were un-American. So we had an enormous explosion. And Howard Bowen, who went on later then to be a distinguished president with the State University of Iowa, was dismissed summarily from his job and later took a job at Williams College, I think, in the East, and went from there to Grinnell and from there to Iowa. But meanwhile, the situation at the University of Illinois was rather unpleasant. In 1953, I did receive an inquiry from Dean William L. Ayers to come to look at a job at Purdue. The job was as head of the department, which I had not been at Ohio Wesleyan. I had not been at the University of Illinois. And this looked to me as a continuation of the kind of pleasures we had had at Ohio Wesleyan. Purdue was much smaller, was less cantankerous,
There was no infighting in the department.
There was no infighting in the department.
It's true.
The infighting at the University of Illinois was really severe. And I was told by Dean Ayers that Dr. Estee wanted to retire. And when I talked to Dr. Estee, he did not indicate anything to the contrary, which I later learned would be his nature. I went back to the University of Illinois after talking to Ayers and President Hubde and some faculty members, Doc Owen and Thomas, Professor Thomas. They impressed me. When I got back, the succeeding dean, who succeeded Howard Bowen, made a counteroffer which was substantially better than Purdue University's. And I considered for a long time which I should do. Finally decided that the pleasures of being in a smaller school, because at that time Purdue University was substantially smaller than the University of Illinois.
Oh yes, we'd gone down to around 8,000 to 10,000.
That's right.
Illinois was at least double that, even
That's
in
right.
Boston.
Mm-hmm. The pleasures of of working here would be greater than the pleasures of continuing in an environment which had been spoiled somewhat by the severe, the amount of, I'm sorry, as I'm saying severe, I should really say the amount of conflict that characterized the School of Commerce. So we moved over here. And I was amazed when I got here to find that Dr. Esty had not decided to retire. And that, in fact, after they had received my acceptance, they told him that he should retire. This markedly changed the job, and had I known this, I wouldn't have come here.
Well, certainly not. It put you in an unfortunate position.
Yes, but Dr. Esty's a real gentleman.
He was a gentleman, yes.
Amazing person. I went directly to him and said, look, I didn't know this. And he said, I thought you didn't know this. And I went to each of the major faculty members, Doc Owen and Tommy particularly, and said, I really didn't know that this was true. And they said, we didn't think you knew. And we think that's most unfortunate. I think Jay Wiley was here, and I also went to him. See, he said he was convinced of this. And thereafter, these people were just fine, cooperative people. I was terribly careful because I did respect and do respect Professor Esty to consider his wishes on all matters. And he continued to make a major contribution to the program of the department.
Now, when you came here, there were about three people who had published, and you have already named them, Owen, Thomas, and Esty. The kind of work they'd been doing, Doc Owen and Labor seemed to be up to date, but the other two, while men of worth, didn't seem at the time, if I remember it, to be the basis for a good economics department. What I'm leading up to is, when you split off from history and political science, or history and government as they're called, what were your problems? Can you outline them for us? And how did you start to build a Department of Economics?
Professor Owen was well known in his field, and Professor Thomas was really well known in his field. Tommy's work in money and banking was respected. My problem was to get new faculty members who would fit Purdue University. And Purdue University is a quantitatively based university. And at that time, it seemed reasonable to get mathematical economists, statistical economists called econometricians, and to blend them with Tommy and Doc and Jay Wiley. We needed Tommy's and Doc Owen's contributions and Jay's fine teaching ability. But we also needed to be in the mainstream of economic development, which was largely in the mathematical economics and econometrics. So I did get new budget and used the budget to hire people, 1953 through 55, mostly quantitative people. Mostly people who had great promise, but had had some problems because Purdue wasn't very well known. So I tried to get people whose problems were, in some cases, psychological, in some cases.
You went out and got a lot of people like Stan Ryder, Johnson, Hughes, Davis, to the field in which I'm most familiar. These were the finest young economic historians in the United States.
That's right.
We once had them here.
This was at a time when they wanted to do something new. They wanted to do quantitative economic history. And quantitative economic history could not easily have been done on many campuses.
This is true.
So they wanted to pull off a revolution, and they saw Purdue as a means of pulling off that revolution.
And they did. Well, you built other fields too, didn't you? We're just talking for a moment about history, but didn't you start in on some statistics? Didn't you get some men in statistics and lay the basis for a rapidly developing, first-rate program in some of the areas of computer sciences and statistics, or am I mistaken?
We really didn't do as much with statistics as we should have done. We did a great deal of work in a combination of economics and statistics called econometrics, and also in mathematical model building. And this is an area where men are working with linear programming, trying to find ways to optimize a model subject to constraints. Professor Smith did that very well. I can't really think of the other names. Well, of course, Stanley Ryder, whom you've already named.
Didn't you have Ron Stuckey to help you develop a graduate program, or was Ron recruiting for admissions?
That's another story.
I'm ahead of myself.
All right. To a small extent. The first 2 years, 2.5 years or 3 years were spent developing, laying the groundwork for work in economics,
yes.
For graduate work in economics.
All right.
At that time, there was some desire on the part of the president to have work here in business, but defined in such a way as to make it uniquely Purdue. And there was fear that the University of Indiana would object if a school of business were set up on this campus. So a new Department of Industrial Management was organized, I think in 1955, within the schools of engineering.
Engineering.
And the work in accounting that had been in central engineering, as they called it in those days, was moved over to this new school of the new Department of Industrial Management, which was within the schools of engineering. And I received a budget to hire people in this area. It's at that time that Ron Stuckey, who was in ag economics, moved over to be a professor in the Department of Industrial Management. We recruited John Day, who's currently dean of the school, John C., who's currently a professor in the school, James Parks, who has since moved, and some other people. And I operated at that time as a department head in the schools of engineering and the department head in the schools of...
It was then called School of Science.
School of Science.
Yes.
This was an enormous burden. I had to go to two sets of promotions meetings, two sets of department heads meetings. Just an enormous complication because I worked for two deans.
Well, now is this the genesis of the Krannert School and of the present IM program, or did that come as a result of the situation? Something had to come from this. Did you organize it? Was it suggested from the outside that you combine the industrial management and the economics into what is today the Krannert School? How did that come about?
Well, I'll tell you some things that are not really confidential.
Well, do you want them for the tape? If they're
right.
For the tape, remember, these are for the archives that will be looked at.
That's all right.
Fine.
I think we're old enough now to deal with the question. There were real complications working for two beings. It was difficult to get the kind of persons I wanted to come to a school or come to a department that didn't have school recognition. Now, just in 1956, I was asked to make a study of the Wharton School and make recommendations for the Wharton School. At this stage, they were without a dean, and they had gone through some difficult periods, and the dean that had been there had allowed the Wharton School to run down. So I did that during the fall and winter of fall of 56 and the early spring of 1957. At the end of the study, they asked me to come to the Wharton School as their dean. attempted boarding schools of fine reputation.
Surrounded by plenty of ivy.
And however, I just built a house, which I hated to leave, and I liked Purdue, and I liked the Middle West. And I was trying to puzzle this through, and I realized that, as I did this, I realized that I didn't really, there wasn't anything more I could really get from either of the two deans I was working for. So I went to see President Hovey and said, I have this offer, and I'm going to take it. I really can't turn it down, much as I'd like to stay here. He said, what would it take to keep you here? And I said, a new school. Because I think these two departments could be combined into a separate school of industrial management. I stalled off the University of Pennsylvania for a week while President Hovey puzzled about this, and then was told that the trustees had decided to go ahead with the creation of a new school, which would include the Department of Economics, which came out of the School of Science, and the Department of Industrial Management, which came out of the Schools of Engineering. So that in I think the spring of 57, a new school was created on the campus. At that time, we had very limited facilities. I think you remember the facilities that had been created for us.
Yes, you were in the back end of the Stanley Cooler Annex.
Annex.
Yes.
Actually, Prexy had been pretty generous in giving us funds to redo that. We'd gotten the library started in the first floor. We had started a new graduate program, both in economics and industrial management. And we did have new office facilities in the second floor.
Let me ask you the real important thing. As I remember it, everybody was shocked at the quality of these young men. What is the secret of your recruiting?
If there is a secret, I don't think there is one. It's to go to good schools, get young men who want to do things, and know what they want to do. Hire them. Give them a chance to develop and get rid of your mistakes. And the getting rid of your mistakes is probably as important as anything else.
You mean sometimes you may hire a man who will not work or doesn't live up to the promise?
You can always remember the good young men that stayed, but you must remember that at the end of the first or second year, you can tell a number of them weren't going to work. And academic work consists largely of working alone and working hard. And some people couldn't do this. And when it was clear that a young man couldn't do this, I would quietly, without making any noise about it, try to find him another job, a good job. And I suspect that the secret of recruiting is largely the secret of knowing when not to keep a person.
Of course, sometimes they'll get away from you. Even when you want to keep.
Oh, yeah, we had this all the time because Purdue obviously is not a first grade at that stage, is now a first grade school in the social sciences.
And so let's come back to that topic because I'll ask you your opinion later about business schools.
Well,
so let's go ahead. You're not creating the school. Now you're a dean in 57 and you have a school. What's the next problem?
The next problem is to get some first-rate graduate programs, ones that we could be proud of.
Then it wasn't undergraduate work then. You had enough men for that.
Yes, the old Department of Economics was a first-rate undergraduate operation. You know, there's nothing couldn't do much to do within a major university to improve on that operation. Our next big move was to get a graduate program going. And one that we could be proud of. And again, our strategy was to do something that was different. If we were to try to be a second Harvard, we would turn out being a fifth grade Harvard. And the Purdue environment, because if you've got a man that would really qualify for the Harvard Economics Department, he wouldn't be here very long.
He'd be at Harvard.
Either Harvard or Northwestern or University of Illinois, he wouldn't stay at Purdue. So our big problem was to define what we wanted to do in our graduate program so that we could do something different that would be useful in the and recognized as useful in the academic environment of that period. And again, we turned to mathematical economics, quantitative economics, mathematical work in business, quantitative studies in business. And we tried to recruit around that. We tried to recruit young men for graduate work in these areas. Now, at this stage, the major departments of economics and the major departments of business or schools of business didn't really believe this was a useful thing to do. They were doing the descriptive things. So that you could get the revolutionary fervor of young men who wanted to go to a place where new things were being done as a means of recruiting people. I still think this is true, Bob. I think if you try to do, if any department tries to do exactly what's done other places, it's always going to be second or third rate, particularly in a new school.
Well, the law of academic gravity, I think, works, and I haven't seen it broached. A first-rate man will not work for a third-rate man, and a third-rate man can't hire a first-rate man. And if I've seen it proved in at Purdue, and within 2 years in departments that we will not mention.
That's right.
But this is true, and you didn't have that, did you? You had a really, in a sense, a clean slate upon which to write.
Yeah, this was an advantage. We had the advantage of a late start.
Very good. Well, you certainly took advantage of it. Of course, you had to have money. Would you care to, is this the next step to talk about how money was secured for your program and for building the school? Or is there something else we should
do? Well, we tried to get government grants to support research, and we were successful. I guess the first real success we had in money raising was with the Ford Foundation, and they gave us $250,000. Or possibly even more than that, just to support freedom for faculty. We could do anything we wanted with these, with this money.
You built, the thing that I'm familiar with is that you built your library so very rapidly, and you did it well. You had a lot of money for books, starting out from scratch almost. Because I remember when the budget for history, government, economics at Purdue was less than $3,000 a year for a department of 20-some men.
Well, you must remember that Dr. Estee was an economist. Dr.
Yes.
Estee spent a large part of his budget on work, on good books in economics.
Yes, I remember he bought a first edition of Ricardo, which was kept in his office.
And we, so we had a good base in that area.
Yes.
Then we put Ford Foundation money into the library. We used the Ford Foundation money for two things. We used it either for library or for release time for faculty. I insisted that the university ought to pay the cost of getting good faculty here, and you'd be amazed how quickly they would agree with this.
And the word got around.
And Fred Hupty was very generous. We said it would take this much to get a man, he'd say, okay, that's what it costs to get a man, you'll go get it.
We have omitted, well, we're talking about leadership, we have, in a sense, omitted mentioning the two deans under whom you had to work. Is it, do you want to make any comment on that or not?
I really had very little contact with George Hawkins. I was only worked under him for a year and a half. I respected his way of proceeding. Duffy L. Ayers was another matter. I think he really favored the development of economics that we had going. And he was quite generous in his budgetary decisions. He hesitated to delegate anything. He wanted everything brought in, even to the way you handle your supply and expense budget. This made it difficult to work with him. It made it difficult for him to cover many fields. He could get so engrossed in the details that at times he really didn't know what was happening in the broader areas. It was a little difficult to work for him. There are all kinds of tricks you get working with him, such as spending the first hour and a half of an interview on minor details, and then at the end saying, in addition, I need two professors that will be so cost so much, and he'd grant the two important things you bring up at the end, and worry over the size of a paper budget. So you learn how to work.
Oh yes, and you work with it. Of course, what I was really getting up to then was the decision in which we, the university, had Mr. Cratter become interested. I don't know this story, and I think for the archives, it ought to be told.
Fred Huffy, I think in 1960, called me over to his office to say that he had met a man at the Inland Container who would like to put on a management development program for their people. I went to see him. He was quite general in his description of what he wanted. So I suggested that possibly I should see Mr. Cratter to see what he wanted. But it was very clear from the first interview that the man that Fred Huffy knew really just wasn't running Inland Container. So I asked for a chance to see Herman Cratter. Found him to be an exciting man. He's decisive, he's quick, he sizes up people quickly. And on the second interview with him, I said I didn't really think there was any point in putting on a management development program for his people at Purdue unless he was prepared to adopt some of the new methods of management, which I couldn't see being used at that time in a container. And he was intrigued by somebody who would be this blunt with him. He said, okay, go ahead. And I said, well, it'll cost something. He said, I know, go ahead. Cost isn't important. Just you go ahead and then you work with us to see whether you can make these methods work. And we came back to the campus with the chance to go to put on this program, and then we were puzzled about how to do it. There were certain kinds of rules against extra payment for faculty, which I'm sure, Bob, you run into when you give a talk before the...
Unfortunately, as the chairman of a committee for a foundation that doesn't pay me anything, I can't get it. I'm not obstructed.
I know, but in this case...
It's true. I've run in once or twice.
In this case, we needed to have faculty people go down into the Inland Container environments and learn what they were doing
sure.
in order to develop cases, and then use these cases for presentations in our own extension program.
Mm-hmm.
And we were told that we couldn't pay faculty for doing this, since they're already fully paid by Purdue University. And I just went ahead to do it anyway. And making commitments to the faculty that we would somehow pay them for the extra time they put in away from the campus, as if they were being consulting, as if they were consulting with them.
You can get by with a consulting fee at Purdue.
Yeah, but the payment had to come from Inland Container in a block to Purdue.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember a big struggle or a big hassle with the business office about this. But eventually this got
resolved,
and we were able to pay the people for the extra work, and they were able to put on a good management development program in the course of this, I kept seeing Mr. Krannert every 2 or 3 weeks to report to him what was going on and how, in fact, his people were doing here, or how we saw them working in the company. The acquaintance developed into a friendship. I learned that he was an engineer who had gone into business. I pointed out that we had a graduate program, our MSIA program, which was specifically designed to help engineers make the transition into business, and that that kind of program was one he should be interested in. He agreed that it was. Meanwhile, we were able to get him to come to the campus to speak to his own people who were in this management development program. And I broached the question then whether he would like to sponsor the Krannert Graduate School of Industrial Administration. He asked, in typical businesslike fashion, what will it cost him? I said it would cost him a new building, or a large part of the cost of a new building, and a trust fund to assist faculty in doing new things.
That is, your emphasis is not, the building is obvious, but your emphasis as dean was upon getting a faculty who were not only good, but also were given the conditions to produce and the inducement with which to do it.
This is right. And in fact, the bulk of the funds that came from Herman Krannert were for faculty. It turned out in the end that
I don't think that's generally known.
It turned out in the end that he didn't put very much into the building. He's a kind of person who likes to operate on an incentive basis. He said, I'll put up, I think, $1.5 million towards the building, and you find the rest of the money for the building. This was enough for Purdue University to find some additional funds for the building. And in the end, he put up more than $1.5 million for the building, but he put up about half the cost of the building. The rest of the funds then went into a trust fund. The rest of the funds were to be used to do 2 or 3 things, which are spelled out in the trust agreement. Number one, to make additional payments to faculty over and above their Purdue salaries to keep them here. And at this stage, when we were negotiating the trust agreement, he said, well, how will I know that these funds won't be substituted for Purdue University salaries? And our reply to that was that no faculty member's salary could be supplemented whose income was not already in the upper 10% of all Purdue salaries. So that if a faculty member fell below the 90th percentile, he was no longer eligible for Krannert support. This satisfied him. I think it's still unique among trust agreements. See, this way we can pay a man $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 if it were necessary. Even though the Purdue salary were only, say, $25,000 to $30,000. So there's no reason why we couldn't have, you name it, if money could bring in here, there's no reason why we couldn't have it. Secondly, it was to be used for faculty in the first place. Secondly, it could be used for release time for faculty. It could be used for libraries. So long as the library acquisitions were not something that Purdue University itself should be expected to make. Thus, we bought rare books.
A rare collection, such as the Roswell collection,
yes.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm. And at the present time, the school has approximately $300,000 a year, in addition to its Purdue budget, for supplementing faculty salaries, giving faculty time to do other things.
All right, may we go off the tape for a moment? All right, we're back on the tape. You were talking about the $300,000 extra for collections and books in the inappropriate fields for the school. Where were other sources of funds besides Mr. Krannert? Did you have any other generous benefactors?
No, we haven't had. We've worked the regular granting agencies pretty hard. Whenever a man thought he might have a chance for a National Science Foundation grant, we would use Krannert funds, if we could, to spring him loose from classes so that he could write a good proposal. And then either John Day or myself would back it as much as we could with statements and help him get funds from out the outside. We also helped write proposals for the Ford Foundation, for various other granting, Brookings Foundation, to get funds for work in these areas. But we haven't had any individual funds, large individual benefactors. Bud Goodman helped us a couple of years. We've gotten money from corporations in small amounts, $5,000 to $10,000.
Do they, corporations tend to ask for a solution of a problem in the sense of application to their operation?
No. In fact, corporations are not a very good source of support. Normally, if they give funds, they give it to make the funds free from all strings, because they normally would not take a real problem to a company. They'll get a consultant to do that.
Well, now, did this take up a great deal of your time as being?
Well, taking care of Mr. Krannert took a great deal of time. His $300,000 grant was just funded within the last 6 months. This $300,000 came annually from gifts that he would make. It was included in the trust agreement, but no trust agreement can be written so that it couldn't be abrogated by either party. So I'll go back a step. He asked me to be a member of his board.
He was a board of Inland Container.
Inland Container. Then he asked me to be a member of his executive committee. And he asked me to be a large investor in a container. And this he more or less expected as a result of his relationship with the school. So I found that as dean, I was largely involved, or not largely, partly involved in keeping Krannert funds coming to the graduate school, because the bulk of the funds were not for the building, which was a one-shot operation. They were for the continuing, ongoing program of the school. And this had to go on month after month. And in fact, is still going on to a certain extent. It's particularly true since the Krannerts, Mr. and Mrs. Krannert, are still continuing to make grants to educational institutions.
Yes, they haven't just finished the Krannert Art Center in Illinois?
Oh, yes, but even more than that, the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts.
That's what I meant, yeah.
It's a magnificent structure. It's $15 million or more in cost.
It's to be regretted that the $15 million were not placed at the disposal of the school of Purdue.
That's right. But after all, Mr. Krannert's a graduate of University of
Illinois. Oh, yes, and very grateful, as I understand.
That's right.
Well, now, excuse me.
Well, I should say that John Day became Associate Dean, I think, in 63, or was it 63?
I was going to ask you about that, yes. He was to do the inside, and
he was to do the inside, and I was to do the outside.
All right, now, just what does that mean for the record?
It meant that John administered the budget. subject to my review. And I was available for, to the outside, to the, I raised quite a lot of money during this period. In little bits and pieces, I appeared in many businessmen's meetings. I represented Purdue and trying to put the graduate school on the businessman's map, because they are the hirers of our people. In the end, since we're a professional school, they're going to determine our success.
How true.
And somebody needs to do this, so I spent most of my time doing that. This doesn't show up on a very, hard way of putting it, but it's difficult to list all the things you do in a year if you take this function seriously. I think all the deans on the Purdue campus should be largely concerned with the outside representation of their schools, and they should have inside men do their inside job, because a university doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's got to be defended. And the best defense is that is to have the supporting publics know what they're doing.
What kind of public relations then for the school would you do? Would you go to conventions, let's say, of sales, or do you make talks?
I was two or three years. I spoke to the Indiana Manufacturers Association. Spoke to the bankers' associations. I was involved with the bankers' associations as a participating member. I was on two governor's committees of businessmen, one to redo the highway commission, another to redo the personnel system for the state. It's this kind of thing.
Now, in the course of this, did you run into hearty cooperation from, say, IU School of Business and other such places?
No, they were terribly opposed to what we were doing.
That is, they saw really no differentiation on the engineering ground, such as...
No, they'd already been educating engineers. They couldn't see why they shouldn't just continue doing it.
In other words, we didn't need another school of business in the state.
That's what they argued. Actually, we changed their way of doing things quite a lot. They became quite a lot more quantitative.
I remember I used to go down with Davis and Hughes, you know, to the economic history group. Those groups were discontinued a few years ago, but I learned quite a lot about IU down there. They are more traditional, aren't they?
They're
still
more traditional.
Accounting and so on.
Yeah, they still are.
Do we have other schools of business in the state that are worth noting?
Well, all kinds of schools of business. Notre Dame University has a good, non-quantitative school of business. The two other state schools have the standard schools of business.
Butler has one, too.
We stuck to our last, which was quantitative work.
Well, while we're on this now, just rate us. How would you rate us? Of course, I don't expect you to be non-prejudiced, but how would you rate Purdue, the Krannert School, as it stands now? Excuse me, we'll go off the tape. We're back on the tape now. I was going to ask you to make an evaluation of where Krannert School, that is where Purdue stands in graduate business and industrial education in the United States, and compare it with first, the schools in the Big Ten, and then other schools nationally.
The Big Ten probably have to rank Purdue's Krannert Graduate School. Not as... Probably the University of Michigan and the University of Indiana are the two strongest schools of their kind. In the quantitative area, I think the Krannert Graduate School is probably the strongest. don't know how to compare these three schools. I would certainly not rank Minnesota, Iowa, Michigan State, Wisconsin, Ohio State as high as I would both Michigan and Indiana.
What about Northwestern?
Northwestern is just now coming back, but Northwestern was not very good. Either in the quantitative area or in the non-quantitative area. Now, recently they've done very well. They've hired some of our people, unfortunately.
Yes, I know they have.
And they're trying to do the quantitative development, and they're doing quite well now.
What about Illinois? I noticed you didn't mention that, or you...
Well, Illinois didn't recover from the...
Bowen fight
for a long time, and they just now, under Dean McGuire, are starting to recover.
Now, when we say this, this means also graduate work in economics, too?
No.
You call that separately?
I'd look at that separately, you know. University of Minnesota's graduate work in economics is very good.
Is Illinois' graduate work in economics good?
No. It's mostly old-fashioned. I now define good work in economics as being largely non-ideological, quantitative, tough-minded econometric research. And in this area, Minnesota's good. Michigan has some strength. Schools that have very little in this area include Iowa, Michigan State, Illinois.
I notice you haven't said a word about Wisconsin.
Wisconsin's probably pretty good as an old-fashioned reform the world kind of economics.
It is like the kind of that I read today, the great text on public utility management.
Yes.
How to keep the naughty public utilities from robbing the public.
That's right.
Yes. In other words, John R. Collins kind of.
That's right. They still have a John R. Some strength from the John R. Collins days.
Yes.
They've gotten a group of people there that do this very well. I don't think that's where the future of economics is going to lie.
Now, I want to come back to this. What about Chicago? We haven't mentioned Chicago. Of course, it's not Big Ten.
University of Chicago School of Business is first rate, and it's clearly better than Purdue's.
All right. Who else is better than Purdue? Would you put Purdue in the top dozen?
Well, probably in the top dozen. I think Harvard Business School is first rate. Carnegie Tech is very, very good.
But they've gone in through high selection of quality, haven't they, and not numbers?
That's right, they have. And they've also very strong emphasis on quantitative work. Stanford is first grade, both in quantitative and in non-quantitative work, casework. UCLA is very good. The Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania has come back under Willis Wynn.
Now, you just jumped over the South. Anything in the
There's
South?
There's nothing in the South.
That is in business schools.
Huh.
Isn't that interesting?
Well, life is too easy.
I know this is hard work. But we haven't, how would you place places like Yale and Cornell and
Because they don't really have anything. Yale doesn't have anything in business. They don't believe in this.
I see.
And Cornell has a hybrid kind of program, sort of half business and half industrial relations. They've never done very much with business. Columbia has suffered from too much consulting. They have some very good people, but they're not there. And Columbia's had its problems in trying to build a program.
You know, you fascinate me about you, because, as you know, I have a interest in business history, and it has to do with natural gas and its regulation, and some of the finest books are produced by men at Yale in this field. That is the...
By the way, I should have mentioned that the Yale Economics Department is one of the finest in the world.
In other words, this is a different
thing. This is the Economics Department.
Yes. Yes, it is.
And they're first rate. In fact, in economics, if you're considering economics departments, Yale is probably better than Harvard.
At the moment.
Yes, at the moment. But
it goes up and down.
Yeah.
But you would put Purdue, though, in talking about business and industrial management, in the top 10 comparing with any group.
Yes, probably. Maybe top 15.
Well, I think that's the fair and probably very modest estimate. And that is because, largely, of the faculty.
Entirely so. The building has very little to do with it. Faculty and the quality of graduate students you get.
You put a great deal of emphasis, then, upon the recruiting of graduate students. In other words, you're Mark Hopkins and the law, aren't you?
Yeah. These are the three elements of good education are faculty first, student second, library in between. If you have those three, you can have a fine institution with lousy facilities otherwise.
Well, of course you're going to have. Let me ask this while we're on it. Is this to be encouraged, do you think, at Purdue in the future?
Well, Bob, will you restate the question? What do you mean by this?
By this I mean the encouragement of the area of business and industrial management. Does the future look bright for it? Will it be encouraged as far as you can see?
I think it will, as long as Purdue's Krannert Graduate School does what it can do best, which is to work with the continuing education of engineers and scientists. If we try to be a University of Indiana with a broad-based, general business program, I don't think we'll get the support we need. The trick here is not to let the school get too big.
And to keep it specialized.
And to keep it specialized.
Yes.
And to get specialized type people.
Yes.
Faculty.
Yes.
Megalomania would be our downfall.
Yeah. Well, I would suspect that, but I wanted to have it on the record. Of course, you realize we're talking largely about your own achievements and getting it up this far. Did you have time for any publication while you were doing this job?
No, not really. I did an article or two, but maybe a book or two, book review or two, but particularly after the Krannert involvement started, I was just completely committed. This is
the building problem. Maybe you don't want to talk about it, but within, I noticed you didn't have department heads. You have a committee structure. Is this unique in the kind of operation that you were building?
No. Harvard, for example, the Graduate School of Business at Harvard has no departments. And the same thing's true at the University of Chicago. It's questionable whether any professional school should have departments. The problem of a professional school is to deal with the whole subject matter of the area. And if you break this into pieces, you get very little work in synthesis. Now, at this point, we have a real problem, which is unresolved, and that's how to handle an economics department in this environment.
Is this a particular environment that makes it different from other environments?
Well, most business schools don't have economics departments. In just the accent of how we started. We started as an economics department and developed into a school of business. As a result, the economics department has always been a very important part of this school and always has been has provided a graduate strength, provided people interested in quantitative work. But an economics department wants to maintain its entity as an economics department, whereas people in marketing and accounting and quantitative work really don't care so much about this. They're interested in the whole of the professional aspects of their work, how they can relate to the problem solvers in a business. Whereas an economics department member wants to relate to other members of other economics departments. And we have an unresolved problem, and that is how
You're going to resolve that one very quickly.
I don't think we are either.
If ever. Now we're on this. We were talking about, and I shut you off. Now we can. I think it's right for us to go into it. What about the future development of the study of economics? You started on that, and I said we come back to it. Now let's go.
You mean at Purdue, or?
Well, generally, and at Purdue too. After all, we're after your views on these matters.
Well, I'm inclined to think that the study of economics nationally is going to be centered in the quantitative aspects of the.
Now, just for the record, what do you mean by the quantitative aspect?
A man will state an hypothesis, a testable hypothesis, and then he'll look at the evidence, and he'll say that the evidence is consistent with the hypothesis or it's not. Now, this is very different from doing the kind of work that Kent Galbraith does, for example, whose hypotheses are not testable. Essentially, he's concerned with ideology.
And whether or not the economic circumstances fit the ideology.
Yes, right.
I've suspected that.
That kind of economics department, economics have probably doesn't have much future. Although it's the portion of economics that appeals most to the liberals, for example, because they find in it reinforcement for their views. In the end, the economics is, I think, going to be largely a body of tested hypotheses. Now, that kind of work is going forward very effectively at University of Chicago, at Yale, to a limited extent at Harvard, UCLA, University of Minnesota. I think that Purdue can do this kind of work and do it very well. So I think the economists here, if they stick to their last, can do very well. But our problem here has been in the last 5 years that the department has wanted to define its task and its total task in narrower and narrower, in a narrower and narrower fashion. They now want to do not tests of the effectiveness of, well, I'll take an area in your case. It's clear that in the regulation of natural gas that there are some hypotheses that can be made, some tests that can be made. And they don't want to get that close to reality. This, the Yale department's willing to do, or UCLA is willing to do, but increasingly in the last 5 or 6 years, this department's wanted to go off and do, set up models and test the internal consistency of the model, which doesn't require that you look at reality. And then they want to recruit other people who can do this.
It requires a highly specialized language, so that in the end only 20 people can communicate in
that's
these
right.
languages.
That's right. I don't I don't think this is going to work. I think it's that the economics won't survive on that basis. It becomes how many angels can dance in the pinpoint of a needle.
Getting back to scholasticism.
And scholasticism in the old days was thought of as largely ideology. Now, in the modern economics department, it's thought of as mathematics. But it's still scholasticism.
An exercise in intellectual pyrotechnics.
And this is the way the department's going, and departments have a way of establishing their own vectors of force. There isn't much an administrator can do about it until it's perfectly clear that this isn't going to work. Then an administrator can do something about it.
Then he can lower the boom if he has to.
Yeah. But up to that time, it can go too far, and that's what I find that's happening here. It's not that the work isn't first rate, but it's first rate in such a limited dimension. And so few people read it. It has such a little contact with the world that it just can't help but be of limited value.
How does American economics and what we're doing here, you see, compared to, what's being done in the better economic studies in Europe, are we setting new trends with our econometric concentration?
Yes, actually, Europe isn't doing very much economics these days.
I thought they were quite acute in studies in marketing and that sort of thing.
No, the marketing is almost entirely done in this country. It's amazing that...
In other words, in this field of business economics cum business, we're still ahead of
them. Oh, yeah.
I remember Ed Ames, what fascinated me, the study of Russian economics, where the Russians actually don't know where they are because they haven't changed the system of accounting or reporting for
since
1910. They have the slightest idea what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, Ed was a fine scholar, too, in Russian economics.
Well, now on this, let's say it for the tape, I hope that you will put a list of your books and major publications which can go into the appendix. Are there any that you'd like to mention which you're particularly fond?
Oh, I think the book I did in 1953 called The Economic System
would be the one that
would be the one I'd really emphasize. It's the one I'd like to do over in 1970, by 1973.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to do it?
I'm in the process of doing it.
That's fine. Now, we'll have that list. Now, also, I should like to go back, and we try to do this with each person. I would like to have you tell me your academic and other honors that you would like. I trust you will list them too for the appendix when of the manuscript. What did you do in undergraduate? Did you get any special honors?
No.
You were
I worked my way through school.
All right, you're Phi Gamma Delta.
I'm Phi Gamma Delta.
All right, in business honoraries and fraternities and societies?
Oh, just the standard thing you do as a faculty member, which should be very important. Beta, Gamma, Sigma.
All right. What in the business world
I'm a director of Inland Container, CTS Corporation, Commercial Solvents Corporation, and College University Corporation.
Now, what is the latter? I was not aware of this.
It's an insurance company.
Insurance?
It's essentially a college life insurance company.
I see.
John Burkhart, an old DePaul friend of mine, runs it.
Oh, I see.
I just...
In other words, is this, you're in an advisory capacity?
In the same sense that any director is in an advisory capacity.
Well, now you've left off one, though. Aren't you on the Board of Trustees of DePaul University?
Oh, yes, I'm on the Board of Trustees of DePaul University. And that's very interesting.
I think it would be. Now, is there anything you'd like to talk about that we haven't put on the tape?
I might talk about the unique opportunities that I think Purdue has in the future. The The land-grant schools were originally created to teach people how to do things. And for a long time, they taught people how to plow straight furrows, wire television sets, very practical things. And then as we became more, quote, respectable, unquote, we began to teach a fair deal of theory, mathematics, physics, biological theory. And in doing this, we're probably becoming very much like the other universities in the country. And we're always likely to be second rate if we try to do what everybody else is doing. And it seems to me we have a unique opportunity to do, Bob, what you've been doing with natural gas. That is to develop an hypothesis, to develop a theory, perhaps derived logically from some set of premises, and then take that theory to a known body of practices or of data and try to apply it. In other words, to work in between theory and application. That this is the new kind of land-grant patent, and that we haven't really defined that yet. I can take some many examples. We're now concerned with pollution. Pollution is partly a problem of theory. It's partly a problem of dealing with specific facts, with the way a paper mill actually operates. You need to know more than physics to know how to dispose of waste from a paper mill. You have to know something about that specific set of paper mills in that specific part of the country. And it requires a fine kind of intelligence that takes a great deal of imagination to take a body of academic knowledge to a specific problem. And this, the many of the fine universities in the country are not doing.
And what we're really doing is forgetting our birthright in technology and science, which was the magnificent way in which the Americans could take a problem and apply it.
That's right.
And we're slipping on that.
Yeah, and Purdue has a chance to do this in a way better than most universities, because we have this land-grant background.
And a tradition.
Tradition.
I'm glad you said this, because in other interviews I've heard it mentioned too. In other words, I've asked, what does Purdue do? And you have answered it as you see it. That is, we have an opportunity and a service here.
And an area in which our faculty can have a great deal of fun. You know, in the end, the faculty will do what it enjoys doing most. And if we try to become an imitation of another university, the standard academically oriented university, where our faculty will always escape to the prototypes when they get a chance. If we're trying to do something different, we're going to attract the kinds of people here who will enjoy doing this. Now, this
have the imagination.
Purdue for them will be a challenge, and not a university a cut or two below the standard universities like University of Chicago, Harvard, Yale.
Of course, I happen to think that in the engineering field, we've turned the corner. We're going down the theoretical side so fast. Only thing I know that we'll do is when all of a sudden our graduates are coming back, they tell me they now are, and saying, you didn't train me for this job. You trained me in theory, and I'm out. What do I do?
I think some of the liberal arts areas have got problems of this kind, too.
Yes, sir.
Because they can be so concerned with professional advancement within their area that they're not concerned with the general student or with the way history is can be used to see the present scene. You name it. We can be counting commas in Shakespeare.
Or the ablative absolutes in their role in Chaucer.
And this is just as disturbing in many ways. I think, Bob, that's just about it.
All right, and I want to thank you for a very pleasant interview, and we will now terminate the interview with Dean E. M. Weiler.